Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm the director of training here at the North Carolina Fire Base. And, you know, every so often I get a chance to interview someone who I've kind of like passed in the night with, you know, and this gentleman, he and I, we definitely run in the same circles with, you know, working with different magazines that we both write for or we've been featured in. We have mutual friends and we're both, you know, advocates of hunting, fishing, firearms and whatnot. And I'm just really excited to have this guy on the show. Who I want to introduce you to is Mr. Rob Gearing, also known as @Spartan_Mr. G. So please check him out and you will be just as jealous of some of the cool trips that he has done that I am definitely jealous of, like fishing in Greenland and Bolivia and all over. But we're going to talk right about it. Right now he's on the road. He is in the lovely United States, but he's a good friend from over the other side of the pond, across the pond. And I just want to welcome him to the podcast. So Rob, welcome, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. That's a good intro. I've just completed a 700 mile day today from Buffalo up to meet some friends in Whitefish. So, but I'm really delighted to be with you and finally catch up.
Oh my gosh. You need to, when you get a chance, I'll send it to you when we get off the podcast. I'll send you an Instagram account, which is, I believe, Overheard in Whitefish. Our friend Andy Stump, who is up there, he posts these things where it's like, wow, you know, this is overheard at Whitefish. And people will say things like, wow, it's really nice that that person has a deer in their yard. How much do you think they paid for that deer? You know, or, you know, what do you think the rental is for the bear that's crossing that person's yard right now? Like, these are actual comments from visitors, which I don't think you're that type of person. I think you're way more, you know, knowledgeable than the average person that goes up there. But just be forewarned, you're going to be in the presence of some people that are coming in from the city and they have no idea how amazing Whitefish is, but also how dangerous it can be if you don't keep your head on a swivel.
Well, let's call them interesting characters, Kevin. Yeah, we meet them for sure. But I've been coming here for a few years, actually. I've got a British friend that used to do voluntary services in Africa, and he looked after a load of people over there. And they used to go and stab each other with spears. He could handle that. And then one of the groups got some AK-47s and came and shot the other ones. He said, I'm out of here. And he moved to Whitefish after that and set up a forge called Iron Thistle. So He's been here for, boy, it must be 25 years. And I didn't even tell him I was coming. I just popped around for a cup of tea. So that was pretty stoked to catch up with him after all those years. But it's a lovely part of the world. And living in the UK, I sort of feel more and more claustrophobic every time I go back. And every time I come out to these big, wide open spaces, I'm sort of in love and quite envious of what you guys have got over here, to be honest.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of Ray Mears and the Bushcraft series that he has over there on the BBC and all the work that he's done. And one of my favorite shows that he has is Wild Britain, where he goes and he does the historical approach to Great Britain. And he's like, well, you know, in this body of water, there were at one time very large salmon and they're just coming back. But, you know, they've been fighting back over the acid rain and this and that. I mean, the United States, I always tell people, you can see pretty much every climate you want in the United States. But to get more worldly, you should travel to these countries like Great Britain, like Sweden, like Finland, like some of these places that are very fun for ecotourism and relatively safe. You know, I think Britain has certain things, like it obviously has a lot of ancient old history that we don't have. But let's talk about the differences between the United States and Great Britain, because one thing that blows people away in terms of, I can't believe they allow that, but they don't allow other things in the United States. To acquire a suppressor for a firearm, you obviously have to pay a $200 tax stamp. You have to go through the Class 3 process, and it is a wait. Like right now, I'm waiting on a 9mm Odessa suppressor from Dead Air Silencers, and that will probably be 7 months. It's very different in England, isn't it?
Yeah, so Kevin, there's two things, only two things that I can think of that are easier for the hunter in the UK than they are in the States. One is suppressors, moderators, silencers, whatever you want to call them. We got them a good few years back because there's a lot of professional hunters in the UK There's not many people that have firearms, but the ones that do tend to shoot a lot of animals. I used to do a lot of deer management over there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing a lot, you tend to get deaf. So we got them for a health and safety reason.
Yeah.
So getting suppressors is pretty easy in the UK. They're still classed as a firearm, but it's certainly not as challenging as it is here. And the other thing that we can do is we can shoot from vehicles. So if we're pest, I know you can do it in Texas and maybe certain other places, but if you're pest control or you've got deer licenses for nighttime stalking and such like, you can do a lot of management from a vehicle. So those are the only two things mm-hmm. that I would say. I might be wrong, but I can't think of anything else that's easier in the UK when it comes to firearms. It's a really challenging place to own rifles and get licensed. And yeah, we could talk about that for hours, and it probably will bore the hell out of your listeners. So we could talk about it if you want, but it's not easy. I think there's 56,000 firearms license holders in the UK last time I checked, with a population of 70 million people.
Wow.
It's a tiny, tiny percentage.
You know, I've had people message me over the years. I've been in the survival game professionally since 2007 when I started teaching at the Wilderness Learning Center. I've had people from the UK say, will you ever put on a class on hunting with a slingshot? But of course, the word that was used was catapult, because they said we can't have small arms over here, but we can have catapults. And I was like, wow. You know, it just makes you appreciate what you have here in this country.
You've got so much opportunity here, and I harp on about this in previous podcasts. I said it's so wonderful. Look, I don't agree with everything that goes on in the States,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that anybody within reason can go and buy a rifle without too much of a challenge. You've got this wonderful thing called public land, which really, really hang on to that because it's so precious. And the fact that you can get young people out, anybody going out and hunting, I think is absolutely magic. And the problem we have in the UK is it's so easy to dislike something you don't get the opportunity to do. And by the sheer fact that we've got so many people living in the UK and we live on this tiny landmass, it's very, very challenging if you haven't got a lot of money, or B, you're not mixing with the right people, or you're not growing up in a farming background. But that's a big challenge. And I talk about this a lot, and I think it's really doing some serious harm in the UK now, because people don't understand hunting, and we're probably 20 years further down the bad line, I'd say, where people get very anti about things just for the sheer fact they don't understand it. I desperately try and explain to people, you know, this is a great thing. I've taken vegetarians out, I've taken vegans out, and actually I've never had anybody, when I've taken them out hunting, turn around and say, well, that was disgusting or terrible. I say, look, things can go wrong. You know, we're hunting. If you shoot things, sometimes it's not going to turn out how you want it to happen. But I'd rather be hunting than live off intensely farmed meat. And with 70 billion people on the planet, you have to have intense farms. I understand that. But I'm very fortunate that I can shoot my game and eat it. And another thing that we can do in the UK is we can sell that meat into the food channel.
That is so rare.
So that's quite good.
I didn't know that about the wild game over there, that you could sell it. That's always been a no-no in any hunt that I've gone on. Many times what they'll do when you go to certain places that will process your game, if you want an immediate turnaround, like many times they'll say, we'll do a fair trade. We'll take a quarter of the deer that you shot and we'll give you X number of pounds of sausage or ground meat, but we can't sell it. We will do a fair trade, you know, and I get that. That's like a workaround. But yeah, that's incredible. I didn't know that about the UK, that you could sell it into the markets.
Well, you talked about Ray Mears. I've done a bit of hunting with him. He hunts on one of the same estates that I hunt on.
No kidding.
And basically, our job over there is deer management.
Mm-hmm.
So a way of financing those deer managers, and it might be arable farms that need deer controlling. It's more likely to be forestry.
Mm-hmm.
The way to pay for that is you often selling the venison. So basically, we get a lot of Swedish people come and hunt with us. They might shoot this is going to sound insane to the average American, but with probably 10 to 15 people out hunting over a weekend, and a few people walking through knowing that land very well, they might shoot 150 animals in a weekend. So it's really productive. So to get that venison in, that actually adds up to be a lot of money. It's a sizable income for the estate that you're shooting on. And remember, all this land is privately owned.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, completely different dynamic to what you got here, Kevin.
you could say that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of what you got here, but I guess it's always the green-eyed side of things. And I come over here and think, God, this is fantastic what you've got. But if you want to shoot a lot of animals, then we probably have some good opportunities for that in the UK. If you're in the right background and you know the right people, but it's not an easy thing to get into.
Wow.
I just had some Americans over up in Scotland with a very good friend of mine on a estate up there. Lovely guy called Joseph von Benedict. He's one of your journalists over here, and we took him for his first red deer stag, which was pretty epic. So he really got a flavour of what hunting in Scotland's like compared to America, and he's doing some stuff on that as well, which is pretty interesting. So always like to, I spend my life going to pretty remote places.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always nice to engage and find out what people think about where they come from. And at the beginning of this year, on January the 5th, I started up in the Arctic. So I was up in the Arctic with a very good friend of mine who wrote the Swedish hunting manual, Ulf Lindtroft. He's a really, really knowledgeable guy. And he's basically a walking encyclopedia when it comes to hunting capercaillie. Now, I don't know if have you ever heard of capercaillie, Kevin?
That is brand new to me.
Right. It's like a turkey-sized grouse. And so it's the biggest grouse in the grouse family. They're an amazing bird, and you actually hunt these out of trees. That time of year, you're on skis and you look for these birds and you use them, you shoot a rifle at them in trees, which always seems a bit crazy to me because you think, well, where's this bullet going to end up? But because you're in such a remote area, i.e. the Arctic, there's nobody there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This was a particularly challenging week we had because the temperatures just plummeted. It got down to minus 38 centigrade. Now, in Fahrenheit, that's probably almost going to equal. I think they equal about minus 40. So really, really, really cold. And we're out on these very long skis. They're 11 foot long. I'm pretty capable cross-country skier, but I've never used these ones before. And there's no skins on them, and Ulf he's very, very good on them, and we're climbing on these skis, and I'd actually got a hernia, and I must have fallen over like 5 or 6 times the first day, and it nearly killed me. I mean, I'm 59, so I'm cracking on, I'm a bit of an old man now, and when you fall over on these skis, it's a bit like falling over in a bowl of soup, because the skis, you're just attached on the front,
yeah,
and getting a purchase to get back up, you use all that core muscle, and I was dead. I mean, it really did struggle. And it was so cold that the capercaillie weren't coming out anyway. They bury themselves in stow holes. So I ended up coming away from that trip with frostbitten, damaged fingers, and I even frost damaged my right eye, and I've never done that before.
Oh.
And so I lost the focal capability to focus my eye. All self-inflicted, all stupid. Should know better that these things happen. And it took me about 6 weeks before my focusing came back again. I was quite worried about that. And so it was a pretty heavy start to the year. But anyway, it all adds. But the reason I was talking about Sweden is they're quite interesting because they're almost a crossover between the UK and America. They have a bit of public land. I do this, Kevin, all the time. I jump down rabbit holes. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries.
But they have a bit of public land and they also have private land. So it's quite an interesting mix there. And they really are a passionate country when it comes to hunting. And there's a lot of women that get into hunting over there now, and they want to do it because they can get organic meat and blah, blah, blah. So it's a good news story all round as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there are so many talking points just from that beginning of the year story. But what I want to do is I want to take us back to the very beginning, because I was doing a little bit of LinkedIn stalking of you and just, you know, reading up on your story. And obviously I've seen the stuff in Recoil and whatnot. And one of the things that I thought was really fascinating was that you, at a very young age, at 16 years old, you left school. And right around then, was that when you became an engineer, or did you kind of feel things out? You didn't want to go through, say, like the proper education channels, or I should say the professional education channels. Did you become an engineer kind of like in a roundabout way, or did you go through a very specific like trade school path?
So that's an interesting question, actually. It's a really interesting question. I left school because I was considered so stupid. I remember school teachers saying to me, you'd be lucky if you had like become a dustman. I don't know what you mean, a guy that picks up the bins. And so I just didn't use my brain in the same way that many people do, I guess. Now maybe they'd call me something or they'd probably have a badge for it. They just considered me stupid. I left school. I did an apprenticeship as a mechanic. I got a distinction, City and Guilds distinction. I then got into aircraft engineering, started overhauling aircraft engines. And that sort of fell into a marketing and sales role. And I had a brilliant boss, ex-fighter pilot, who really took me under his wing and sort of nurtured me and said, Gearing, I want to get you out to university. I want to educate you, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, Paul, I want to go and go to all these remote places and get these engines in. So I was at a very tender age. I was flying all over the world, Northern Canada, Flin Flon, Winnipeg, Himalayas, all going to these remote places where these particular aircraft were operated. And every time I'd go there, I'd come back with an engine because obviously these engines have to be overhauled at a certain time. And these aircraft are obvious. They're operated in the Caribbean and lots of holiday destinations as well. I had absolutely no interest in going to those places, but everybody else did. So I'd turn up in the middle of, I'd go and see Royal Nepal Air, for example, and they'd say, well, nobody's seen us for 10 years, Mr. Gearing. Yeah, take my engine. So there was a lot of lucky circumstances and events that happened in my formative years that sort of pushed me down a channel. But I couldn't get into hunting at a young age. I was passionate about hunting. I shot with an air gun. And we do shoot pigeons and rabbits. But that was really the segue from moving to that to full bore rifles is very, very difficult and challenging. And my big passion as a young person was climbing. So I spent a lot of time climbing rocks, going all over the place, really, Patagonia and such like. I came to Yosemite, I've climbed here. I mean, not to the same league these guys are doing it now. They're like superheroes compared to what I did. But I managed to survive without killing myself. That was the important thing. Mm-hmm. And then at later age, I got into mountaineering. And basically through that, I got into hunting probably in my mid-20s. And I just, that passion just reignited. So for me, if I've got ice axes, fly rods, rifles, it doesn't matter what it is, Kevin, it's just an excuse to be outdoors. And then the design side of things came into my life at a later age following the aircraft engine side of things. But yes, I didn't follow a normal sort of educational career. I didn't go to university. My kids have gone to university. It just didn't happen. And my business, the big boss, he wanted to send me to university, but I was so desperate just to get out and spend time outdoors, I never did it.
Yeah.
And actually, it would have probably been wasted on somebody like me, Kevin, because I just don't use my brain that way. I look at things from a climbing perspective. Mm-hmm. I look at things in a very practical way. And I think, how can I make a tool that will function, do everything I need it to do without breaking? I can keep it simple. Because when you're an alpine, when you're a mountaineer and such like, everything you do, you're carrying on your back, right? So I want to keep weight to a minimum. I want to keep it super strong. And if it can do more than one job, even better. So the whole thing about Spartan and our business is I've tried to develop products that I would use. They're not necessarily right for everybody else, but they're what I would use in my environment. So they've been very specialist, really, and they've been aimed at them. Hunting the mountain hunter till now. Now we're offering subalpine products, and I'm hugely excited about that. But really, so I've just been an absolute nutter when it comes to outdoor stuff. So, yeah, I'm always going to these interesting places, and I love it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned how, you know, your teacher, your professor said to you that, you know, you wouldn't amount to anything. And I've heard that, and I've heard a lot of horror stories, because I grew up in the public world. I should say, prior to working for Fieldcraft, I spent 14 years as a public school teacher. And I remember there was one professional development we had where the speaker, very profound, and it was actually one of those speakers who I feel like after the speaker got off the stage, the superintendent was annoyed that the speaker said this message. But basically the speaker said, you know, we're all trying to get every one of these kids to be college ready. Well, college isn't for everyone. And it's actually kind of scary if you think about it. Like at 18, a kid's got to make a decision on this, probably the second or first largest expense of their entire life that they're going to have to pay back. And they may not mentally be ready for it. They might not be mature for it. And what the speaker said was, you know, if you have a whole classroom filled with fish, and you're teaching the fish to try to fly and they don't know how to fly, well, guess what? The message isn't there. Like that kid was never meant to fly. That kid was meant to swim. We all think in different ways. And sometimes you don't recognize that as an educator. You know, you might be teaching, hey, I'm going to show you the visual way. I'm going to show you the visual way. But that kid needs to get his hands moving. He needs to move around. Like instead of being a visual learner, he's a kinesthetic learner. And that sounds like what you were. It sounds like you wanted to get in there, do things. You wanted to move. You sound just as restless as I am. You know, when you're talking about, you know, climbing out here in Yosemite, I'm trying to imagine what year that was. And were you climbing with like, with aids and with pitons, you know, or were you starting to
Yeah, I'm a traditional climber. I have no interest in climbing a wall that's bolted.
Okay.
Zero interest.
It's okay.
Just like you say, Geary, do you want to go and climb Everest? Zero interest in that as well. I have nothing but admiration for people that do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it's not what floats my boat. Put me on a rock with no protector that I can protect. I'm not going to go and solo something, you know, without a rope. Maybe I've done a bit of that, but only when I've been really confident about the route and have done it a few times before. But literally, I want to be able to put protection in, climb that wall, come off unmolested, and then we're all good to go. And I mean, in later years, I climbed a lot with a very famous climber called Simon Yates. And they did a film on him called Touching the Void.
Oh, yeah.
Basically,
you were involved in that film?
His mate off. Sorry?
I said, I didn't know you were involved in that film.
Oh, no, I wasn't involved in the film. I climbed with him.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
I wasn't part. I didn't know him when that happened. He was a pretty young man. He's my age.
Mm-hmm.
But I've climbed with him in South America. I've climbed with him in Greenland. We did seven ascents. In Greenland about 12, 13 years ago. And we're gonna ski across Greenland in 2025 if I'm still fit enough to do it. My son and a mate of Max and his mate, who's my cameraman, and Simon, and maybe any other nutters we can persuade to come. And we wanna cross Greenland, start in the east and end up on the west coast. So we're working on that at the moment as well. And I think that'd be pretty cool.
So now let's get to your current company, because this is what I always found interesting. You know, I obviously working for this company, we are very active on social media. We have to be, you know, we're constantly posting things and we're putting up videos and we've got a new app that came out and it's like one thing after another, but I remember seeing some of your Instagram stuff that you put out and you're worried about not being fit. Yet I just saw a video of you doing handstand pushups in your hotel room. And I'm like, the dude's doing okay. If he's doing handstand pushups at elevation, you know, he's going to be okay. But you really put out some unbelievable content with just showing the capability of the Spartan system, which I've had a couple people come through. We do a hunter prep class every once in a while, and I've seen the javelin bipod. And then I've seen the video of you supporting yourself on the tripod, all of your weight. And I'm like, oh my God. And then you're like, oh, it's only X number of ounces. I mean, that blows my mind that you can get that much strength out of just carbon fiber. And can you kind of talk about how you achieve that strength?
Yeah, I mean, so what I do, Kevin, I use the best materials I possibly can. And the thing is, you know, those tools are like athletes. right? You have to pick the right tool for the right job. So we really tend to sort of focus on particular things. And that javelin bipod that you refer to, that's very much a mountain hunting tool. And then we make other bipods for different jobs. But the nice thing about the Spartan system, it's all modular. So be it the tripods or the bipods, the legs will all unscrew. You can use the tripod legs and the bipod and vice versa. You can make our tripods into a standing mobile shooting bench. You can add two legs on the back. So it's the best description, I call it, is Lego or Meccano. And you build a system that best serves your needs, because we all do things in different ways. So we're not saying there's a tripod, there's a bipod, go and use it. We're saying there's a system. Now work around these things. We've got different heads, different legs, and we can make it work. Our challenge is, I think we make really good gear. We're not necessarily the best at explaining how stuff works, because we're a young, small company. Mm-hmm. We're all passionate nutters getting out there doing it, but none of us are trained marketeers, and we have fun doing it. And really, the reason the products have developed so well is because we're not arrogant. We listen to the feedback from the customers that use it. And a lot of the finesse that have come about on those products has really come about because the users, have told us what you want. And we go, well, you know, if Jim's saying this and Frank's saying that, we'd be stupid not to do this. I mean, I had a situation really early on. Some of your guys, this side of the pond, some SEALs contacted me. And they said, oh, Mr. Geary, we really like your bipod, the javelin bipod. And I said, well, guys, it's for hunting. And they said, well, forgive us, we hunt people. And I said, well, fair enough. Yeah. So I went over to California and spent a bit of time with those lads and developed another product. And actually, we've started now working with a lot of little units, developing stuff for them. You don't see it on the website because we haven't got around to sort of, we're just not big enough to finance the growth of the defense business and the growth of the hunting business. And the hunting business, well, has grown 35% this year already. And as much as I want to do the defense stuff and throw my energy into that as well, we just don't have the physical resources to do that at the moment. So we're sort of putting a little freeze on that, but I'm super excited, or what you guys would say, super stoked about what we're doing for the defense business, because it really is game-changing stuff. And it's definitely got that Spartan flavor, just as we have done with the hunting. It's really turning that market on its head and saying, no, guys, we can do something different, and we really want to push those boundaries. And I say that in essence as this isn't gimmicks. These are functional tools that people like you and I would use, Kevin, and mm-hmm. you know, go, right, crikey, I've got a bipod here that's not on my rifle, because guess what? In a hunting situation, I'm going to have that bipod less than 0.1% on that rifle when I need it.
Right.
And it's hanging on there at the moment, and it gets stuck in everything. So let's lose that bipod. Let's put it in a simple case. Let's keep it as light as possible. Make it as strong as we possibly can. And that tool, you just pop on when you need it and take it off when you're done.
You know,
fantastic.
Last week,
we started those in Germany. Mm-hmm. 7 years ago, we were told in Germany we'd never sell a bipod. As of 2024, every German rifle maker will be fitting gunsmith adapters in not all their rifles, but they will have a rifle with a gunsmith adapter in that stock. And that's how we've changed that market. Now, if we can do that in the States as well, that'd be fantastic. We've got a long way to go, but we get such good positive feedback from you guys on this side of the pond. It really gives you the energy to keep that fire going. And it's very exciting.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned essential gear, and you know, last week I was just with two of my good buddies, and we did a trip up to Lost Lake near Leadville in Colorado. So I was just out in Denver. I know exactly what you're talking about with that long drive and everything. And some of the essential gear that we had our Onyx, you know, which allowed us to skirt, you know, this one outcropping of rocks, and we didn't get ledged up. And I swear that's like the most essential gear that you could possibly have for navigation out there. And especially when we were going in at dark. But, you know, when you talk about the essential gear, the bipod, you know, I've heard people say, and I believe in this statement, you know, shots are rarely taken in the prone, but your bipods, you can drop them low. Like, I know that the javelin's like really, really short if you want it to be, but I saw something, and correct me if I'm wrong, where you have like a trekking pole, or they can expand to the height of trekking poles. So like, even if you're in a seated position or you're shooting off of a pack and you want the legs to reach the ground, they're going to reach the ground, which I was like, I can't do that with my Harris bipod. And no disrespect to Harris. Harris makes an absolute tank of a bipod.
Kevin, Harris make a fantastic tool. And all credit to that guy.
Yeah.
Look at the materials he had available to him. I mean, that, you know, we've all grown up using them.
Mm-hmm.
And on the range, I'd still use a Harris on Atlas. That's the tool. But from a hunting perspective, our stuff really starts to make sense. And so you talk about the trekking poles. Yeah, you can use the trekking poles in the bipods for sure, but a whole tripod unit, mm-hmm. I don't want to carry a heavy bit of real estate to the mountains in the form of a tripod that's just a tripod and carry two trekking poles. So what we've done is we made the legs removable and we use super strong carbon fiber. It's 1 mil thick. It's really good quality stuff. So those trekking poles are bomb-proof trekking poles. Sure, you can break them. You know, if you stick it between two rocks and fall over, anything's going to break.
Sure.
But the other nice thing about our trekking poles, if you did break them, you just remove the broken section, put it back in, lock it off, you've still got a functional trekking pole. Whereas with any other trekking pole, if you bend them, they're done. So our tripod is your trekking poles and your shooting system and your tripod. So we just shaved off probably 3 or 4 pounds of weight, taken out your backpack, right? So that's how we function. The central column on those are sent tripods. You can have them with a little toolbox in. So they've got a little screwdriver kit and such like, and then you've got something to do your optics and your rifle. So it's really sort of just taking products that little bit extra and providing answers. It's almost like a mini Leatherman tool you've got in the central column if you want one. So that's how my mind works, Kevin, and that's how my mind works, be it climbing, fishing, or whatever. I'm always trying to overcome challenges. I'm always – anybody that does a lot of outdoor stuff knows, and most of your listeners will completely get this, I'm sure, because I'm sure they do a lot of outdoor stuff. Everything you do, the minute you leave your door, is a compromise, right? How do I stay warm, comfortable, dry, well-fed, in good state of health with all these challenges that I'm going to face? That's the challenge. And so that's the tribe analogy that I put when I'm designing products. It has to function. And basically, I take myself all over the world. So as I say, I started in the Arctic. I've just come back from the jungles of Bolivia, right? So I've gone from like minus 36 to some crazy hot temperatures. And it just trying our gear in different places. We were fishing there, but it's still exciting. It's still fun. And it's just, you know, meeting great new people and interesting people and finding those places that get more and more challenging to find on this planet, but those really remote pockets that you can engage with local people. I mean, in Bolivia, these indigenous people we were with, they were just so, they don't have mobile phones, they don't have a currency, they just, and they're so lovely and they're so happy in that environment. And floating up a river with them in their boats, just traveling really quietly, dugout canoes, is a pretty awesome experience for somebody like me.
I've got to ask you, because you just mentioned Arctic to jungle, and now you're obviously in the States, there has to be a set number of gear, like certain items that you never travel without, like inside of a Possibles pouch, inside of like a fanny pack or whatever it is. Are there any items, like I mentioned, I like my navigation stuff, whether I have my Garmin InReach, I've got my Onyx, whatever. Is there anything that you say, I'm not traveling unless I have this, this, and this, and this in my carry-on bag? Or,
well, you just mentioned one of them, Kevin. The Garmin goes everywhere with me.
Okay, right? So Garmin.
I love that tool. That's an absolute essential part of my pack. I have a fairly basic medical pack, but it's got the right stuff in it. I mean, I fell over in the jungle and cut myself really badly.
Terrible place to get cut, by the way.
Between the two fingers.
Yeah.
I will take antibiotics if I need to, but I'm reluctant because it does my gut so much damage and I spend 6 months repairing myself. So if the body can repair itself, I'll do that first. And my wife, she's really into health, but quite alternative. And she got me back and she said, so I urinated on my wounds. And actually people, the guys in the jungle said, you can't do that. You're going to really, and I tell you what, the wound fixed so quick. Right. And he's in such a good state. I'm not endorsing go and pee on yourself, guys, but it's what they used to do on the First World War. But we've sort of come away from practical repair systems that were available to us at times and moved on to instant answers. Well, what happens if those answers aren't there? What
right.
do you do?
Right.
So, of course, I had antibiotics with me, but I refused to use them. I thought, well, if this gets bad, I'll tap into the antibiotics. But I did the urine trick, and it worked wonderfully well. But getting back to your answer, I'll take a head torch everywhere I go, right, little Pedsort, Garmin, Leatherman tool. Can't go anywhere without that. I'm a big fan of merino wool gear because I'm old and I stink quickly, and I don't like changing my gear undies all the time. So all my base layers merinos, my socks merinos, then I go synthetic after that. And then depending whether I'm in the Arctic or the jungle, you know, obviously you change depending on that as well. But I'm really quite simplistic in what I take. I sort of take as little as I can get away with.
Yeah. And that's the key when it comes to high elevation. Like it's so easy. You know, people say, you know, ounces become pounds and pounds become pain. And I believe in that one. And sometimes there's truth to that expression. If you travel light, you freeze at night. But like you said, there's a compromise. At some point you have to say, is it worth carrying this extra puffy jacket, or is it going to weigh me down? You know, is it going to take up space in the pack that maybe more food could take up? Or there's always a compromise. Like you have to look at your backpack like a storage container and say like, okay, you're traveling across country. You can only take what you can fit in here. You know, what do you put in there? And there's always that compromise.
Yeah.
When it comes to your personal gear, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. We did, Ian Harrison from Recon Magazine, very dear friend of mine. We we floated down Frank Church for 7 or 8 days. And I mean, the gear we went with was minuscule, you know, compared to some guys going in when we came out. I thought they had everything, right? But we didn't suffer, Kevin. We did it well. And we've done enough of those kind of things that we know what we can get away with.
Yes.
And I think that comes with experience. And I think you do enough of the kind of stuff that I do, you become very adept at saying, well, I don't need those. I can get away with that. I'm not going to lie. You know, there will be nights when I think, oh, I could have done with an extra down jacket, right? Or blah, blah, blah. But I know I'm not going to freeze to death. So I cut it to the bare bones. I don't take any real surplus, but I'm very cautious about not making unnecessary risks in a dangerous environment. What I would do on an everyday thing, like I would be more, I am like an old man in the mountains, you know, because I've seen too many people come unstuck. And then one thing goes wrong, another leads to another thing. And before you know, you're in the serious doo-doos. So if you're fairly pragmatic about things and you know what's likely to come unspooled, I think you can get away with taking a lot less. Now, I've been lucky up until now, and I might get that day where something goes spectacularly wrong and I don't have the necessary tools to make the right choices. But as I say, life's a compromise, and I make those assessments before I go. And I will pack probably I'm off to Mongolia. I get back from the States in about 10 days. 2 days later, I'm off to catch up with my missus, and then I'm off to Mongolia. And I've already pre-packed that Mongolian trip, right? So my pack is waiting there. And guess what? I packed everything in there, and I will go through that pack 3 times and whittle stuff out every time.
That's the engineer in you, you know? And I think, like, I know a lot of engineers who are very obsessive about perfection. You know, and that's like the word that engineers don't like using because it's so difficult to achieve like the perfectly flat surface or, you know, like a totally pure substance. Like there's always going to be imperfection, but engineers are always trying to tweak out that last little bit of performance. There's a book years ago I read called The Perfectionist, and it was all about how, you know, engineers have like a different mind and they can obsess over things, but that's how innovation happens. And I'm just curious because of the similarities, like, are there any companies that you think are like, wow, that company is doing next level stuff? Because when I get a chance to rub elbows with different companies, I'm like, I need to pay attention to those guys. Those guys are the ones that are listening to the hunters. They're listening to the fishermen. They're putting out gear that is performing. I mean, obviously your bipods, all of your equipment for precision long range, all of that is top tier. Are there any companies that you look at from an engineering perspective and you say, damn, they're doing it right? Like, are there any that you would say are like you're a fan of?
Yeah, I absolutely, Kevin. That's again a really good question. So there's from a clothing or gear perspective, there's a company called PhD in the UK. They make really top end down bags, jackets and such like, and they will build stuff for you.
No kidding.
And the guy that set that business up has sadly died now. But they really are, my view, probably the world leader when it comes to things like that. And so all of my sleeping bags are PH. I buy them. I pay good money for those mm-hmm. things. They don't sponsor me or anything, but I choose to do that because the stuff is so good. It's not cheap, but they'll make me. So, for example, a sleeping bag, it's a good analogy. I will rarely take a single sleep. I normally run a summer bag, really skinny, in a Gore-Tex shell with a tiny liner on that as well. So I can get away with a lot of mistakes running a bag like that. And then I've got another one that's basically a PhD with a Gore-Tex, but that's a down bag. So I think they're really pushing boundaries. They do some very, very clever stuff there. FHF, make Bino, the guy that runs FHF, Paul Lewis, he makes some wonderful gear, and he's like a mad inventor. He's like me, but doing really good like rifle slings, Bino caddies. He's just got that formative mind where he's never really happy and constantly reinventing. There's another company called Red Kettle. They do some great stuff, but it's all common ground. They're all small businesses that aren't necessarily mad about making money. Of course they want to make money, but they're more driven about making great products. Now, I'm 59. If I was 25, Kevin, I'd probably go, I need to make the money. I'm not going to be on the planet long enough to enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
So my satisfaction and my reward is making the best stuff, designing the best stuff I can to do a job. And then people coming back and say, God, I shot my elk 600 yards off your bipod. We couldn't take. That's hugely rewarding from a designing point of view when people come back. And we get that all the time. Disabled people use that stuff. You know, I'm getting people that can't maybe, they can't use their bodies in a normal way. And I say, come on, we'll sit there, we'll work this out. You've got your wheelchair, we'll set something up. Hugely rewarding. But yeah, there's a lot of good companies out there. Exotac, you must use them. They make good gear as well.
They're some of my good friends.
They're all little companies doing great stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of your highest endorsements, someone, again, we're in the very similar circle because I had Jason Vincent from Field Ethos on the podcast not too long ago. And I know you're friends with Donald Trump Jr., who is a user of your products.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that guy's a shooter. Like, he can shoot. I've never shot with him, but I've talked to people who have, and they say that guy is not a slouch. He is not a poser. He gets out there. You know, granted, you know, he's the son of a former president, but you would never know. They're like, he is a sportsman through and through, and he can press a trigger better than anyone else that has gotten behind a gun.
I'll tell you about Donald Trump.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I went there thinking, well, at first I chatted to him a few times before I met him, and I thought, oh, here we go. It's going to be somebody that guy, I've seen him take some incredible shots. Right. And he knows it. And he's almost got like a computer brain for working out. He can shoot stuff I can't shoot. I'm not a brilliant shot. I like dead things dead. So I'm not going to be punching out 800 meter shots on elk unless I'm really confident and know about to stand behind the product. But that guy ticks all the boxes for me. I say he's actually, considering his background, he's an extremely humble human being
mm-hmm.
that's very focused on what he does. And if he opens his mouth, good things come out of it. So I have to say, I like Donny. I think he's great for the business. He's great for he can do the stuff, and he's there's no bullshit with him. I've been out elk hunting with him. I've seen him take incredible shots on elk. And so, yeah. And he uses our gear, so I'm very happy about that as well. He also uses a lot of other good gear, because there'd be other applications where our gear might not be the right product. But no, good guy. And Jason Vincent's good friends with him. We're hopefully going down to, we're taking some motorbikes down to Patagonia next April, riding down there. So when there's a few other nutters coming with us. So I just like to push buttons, to be honest, Kevin, and trying lots of adventures. I'm not going to be on the planet for long, so I stuff it full.
Yeah, I love that, Rob. I want to talk about one of your bipods in particular, because I've seen a guy in a class use one of these, and it's the Valhalla bipod, which for those of you that are listening and you're not familiar with this, you know, you can categorize bipods with like traditional sling stud attachment. Like you guys can picture like a Harris bipod where it has the two legs underneath, and the vast majority of the mass of the gun, the barrel, the stock, the forend, it's above the bipod. Well, the Valhalla, the only way I can describe it is like a cradle, where the legs actually come up maybe parallel to the barrel, and the entire rifle can cant left and right inside of this leg. So it almost looks like the letter M, and the rifle's in the center. That bipod, is that more, that wasn't meant for the hunting community. That was meant for the precision rifle community, right?
That's absolutely right, Kevin. It's a different, we actually make several different bipods. There's a few more coming out as well. I think the Javelin Pro Hunt Tac has nailed it from the hunting perspective. The Valhalla, although people do use it for hunting, and that's entirely fine by me, it was more designed as a sort of long-range bipod. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about that, again, it's modular, so you can remove the legs, you can put longer legs on. It's also got a hole underneath the bottom, so you can run our tripod directly under the bipod. You don't need to take the bipod off. It mounts on a spigot system, so it's easily removable. It's a cool bit of kit, but a different job, a different tool to do a different job.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got two tripod systems. We've got the Hercules, which has just gone on our website now, which we won some military contracts with for some sniper units. So we're now releasing that to the public. And then we've got the Ascent, which is really aimed at the mountain hunters. And we've just come out with a new system. And that was basically while I was up in the Arctic, was testing with my friend Ulf, because he does a lot of predator control. He basically removes red foxes where they're encroaching on silver foxes. So he wants a very quick system for basically taking out predators. So we worked on a silicon bodied javelin, where you can move the legs really quickly and just get yourself, you're not going to get a perfect shot. It's not what I would call a precision tool. It's a hunting tool. So it's going to enable you to get a very solid support platform, very fast, at moving targets. And then we stretch that on now, and we basically come out with a Springbok quad system. So basically the same thing, but on four legs, uses the magnetic attachment. So there's a whole host of things that you can use with our adapter. So there's a whole family of products, really. And as I said to you earlier, our challenge is explain, you don't need everything. You need mm-hmm. the right tools that serve your needs.
You know, I need to ask you, because, you know, we've been talking gear, and anyone that knows me knows that it's always a balance between gear and skill. And there's like a harmony that exists between the two. So if you have the right gear and you have the right skill set, then, you know, you can do amazing things. And someone with a lot of skill can push subferior gear and still accomplish the task at hand. But there are folks out there that sometimes have amazing gear, but no skill set, and they can't get the job done. So I'm just curious, because, you know, I've taken shooting classes where I've shot off a tripod before, and some of the concepts from shooting off a bipod work conceptually with the tripod, you know, loading the legs of the tripod, you know, pushing forward into it. And then, you know, the other idea is that if you're shooting off a tripod and you're standing, put like a bag or something underneath your firing arm, so it's not just hanging out there and you're not introducing movement. I'm curious what you feel are some of the must-know tips that a person should know before they shoot from a tripod. Do you have any tips or suggestions for someone getting into it?
So I'll go backwards a bit, because you've raised some really good points there. If I can get away with using three legs, I'll always use three legs. because our tripods, you can run three little mini legs on them, and basically in a mount, and I'm really aiming at the mountain environment now, and then we can talk about flatter land later, but if I can get a tripod under me, right, I'm always going to be able to level that rifle up. With two legs, you're going to have other obstacles in front of you. So two legs are great, but if I can run three legs, I'm going to run the tripod. The other thing is I will not load a bipod anymore.
No?
If they're carbon legs.
Oh, okay.
Now, that doesn't have to be a Spartan system because there's plenty of other good bipods out there that have got carbon legs, and I'm sure it works the same for them. But you think of this as your vehicle with suspension now. You're basically putting suspension on that platform.
Mm.
So now all I do is I just take the slack out of the system, right? But I'm not loading. I'm taking the slack out of the system, getting myself comfortable and nested, packing that rear arm. If I've got a bag or a glove, I won't take a bag to the mountains because to me that's something, because I can find something, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's a jacket and stuff it up under there and get myself nice and tight. But you can make an amazing shot like that if you practiced and you tested and you played with it before you put yourself in that environment. And that's the key, is do a lot of dry firing. Do it, you know, people spend hours on ranges. Forget a range. Get yourself in a really awkward situation, because guess what? When that elk pops out in front of you or it's the goat, you're not going to be flat. You're not going to be on a table, right? So it's a waste of bloody time. Get yourself, put your back up, get up, lay on a bed, try and shoot off the floor, right? You know, just put some really awkward positions and practice shooting in an alien environment, even with the other arm, you know, just get used to doing those things, because that's the difference between success and failure.
That's a solid point, you know, and people want to get comfortable, right? They want to go to the range. They want to sit at the shooting bench and they want to, you know, have everything laid out for them and they want to be perfectly flat, but you're spot on. I mean, shoot where it, the ground isn't level.
Nothing wrong in that, Kevin.
Yeah.
You learn the tools that way,
mm-hmm.
right? But then go to the next level.
Yes.
Then go to the bigger class,
yes.
right? So by all means, spend time on the table and on the bench and shooting flat, but then go to the next level. And the next level is, right, I'm going to jack my backside up on this chair. I'm going to put the rifle down below me. I'll put, just make an obstacle and get used to shooting like that. The other thing about bipods and tripods is make sure the foot works for the environment, right? We have, our bipods have a tacky climbing boot rubber shoe on them for good reason, because they stick. But they don't work on everything. So, and spikes are a pain in the ass because they stick in things, right? So we've got a tungsten carbide tip under that. We put a lot of thought into this, because if you're on ice or rock, I was in Scotland last, we went up, the three of us went up and we were shooting hinds, your cows, and we were doing it for meat. So we went up and we wanted to shoot as many hinds as we possibly could. I think we got 9, but we're on mossy, really slimy stuff. And a friend of mine, he's a better shot than me, but he was slipping all over the place on our bipod. Mm-hmm. Right? And I said, just take the rubber boots. Duh. And then he's locked. And he said, oh, God, shit, yeah. Why didn't I think about that? Right? And then he took a nice hind at 220 meters, not crazy distance. But the fact he got himself comfortable, the difference between the tacky rubber boots, and I'm talking about our rubber boots, which were next to useless in that environment compared to the tungsten tips, was a game changer.
Mm.
So it's just taking a little bit of time, but practice these things before you plant yourself in that awkward situation, because you'll probably be, your pulse is going to be ticking over 100. You're going to be super excited. You're likely to be out of breath. Everything's going to happen too fast. If you don't take that time to wind it back, right, you're just setting yourself up with failure.
When you're saying that the boots are relatively useless, is it because the tackiness went away because of the cold and the wet?
No, basically we were on moss.
Okay.
So we were on moss. So those rubber boots work brilliant on dry rock and other things, just like a climbing boot.
Okay.
But knowing I could pull the boots off, it's his bipod. And I said, well, it's my bipod, but he was using it. I said, just use the tungsten tips, Noah.
Mm.
As soon as he got the tungsten tips, he was locked in place, right? And that, the beauty of those bipods, and as I say, not just Spartan system, other systems that use carbon fiber. I'm not here selling this. I'm not a hard salesman. I will never, you know, there's different tools for different jobs and there's plenty of good product out there, guys. But basically the difference was when he took the rubber boots off and he used the tungsten tips, which are just under the boots, That was a game changer. But he wasn't thinking about that. Now, I would think about that naturally because it's my product and I'm used to shooting off those kind of environments. But had he practiced with it before we'd gone, you know, maybe that would have been in almost instinct.
You know, we're coming toward the almost an hour here and, you know, we're running short on time. But, you know, we have a guy that works with us, Mikey Hernandez, and Mikey is our mobility director. And he's someone who's a motorcycle enthusiast and he's our resident gearhead. You've mentioned taking motorcycles to Patagonia and you've mentioned all these different trips. So I've got to ask you, because you're British, Rob, are you a fan of the Land Rover and the Range Rover series? And what motorcycles are you driving?
So I've got the Land Rover Defender, the new one, but the early bird I bought, a guy during COVID went back to South Africa. So I got it pretty cheap off him. I love that Defender. Mm-hmm. The best car I've ever had. Now, other people say something else about it, but I can sleep in the back. I've got a little Yeti box in there. I've got a down bag. I've got a little MSR tank in there. I've got a fire striker, some little titanium bit. I could live in there for a week, but then I don't worry about showering too much. I can wash in a stream and things. That car, to me, is epic. It just ticks all my boxes, and it's very capable off-road. So I'm a big fan of that. And it, luckily, mine hasn't gone wrong. I know a lot of people that have. So I love that Land Rover. Bike-wise, I've got two bikes. I've got a bike in France because we're currently doing the Trans-European Alps. And there's thousands of kilometers. So a pilot mate of mine, actually, he's a pretty famous pilot because he crashed the 777 in 2008 in Tahiti. He didn't. They run out. They had a fuel problem. But I think it's the only 777 to have crashed. And he got it down. There was one broken leg, so he's a hero in my book. Wow. And he's also a climbing buddy. So we've got two, he lives in France, we've got two Honda 250 Enduros in France, and we're gradually knocking off these routes over there. The bikes are a wee bit underpowered for what we're doing, and we're not brilliant on bikes. I just love bikes. But we have a lot of fun. Two old men riding around bikes in Europe. It's in Italy, it's beautiful, good food, good wine. Amazing views and just all these lovely tracks that just need to be discovered. And then at home, I've got a British bike. It's a CCM. It's a British company. They used to do enduro bikes. They now do these really cool, they're like 1950s retro bikes. It doesn't do anything particularly well, but it just looks so cool. And I love riding to work on that. So I have a bit of fun on that. They're the only two bikes I've got. There's a company called Moto Patagonia, who's run by a great guy down there who's got these wonderful bikes down there. So I wouldn't even consider taking a bike to Argentina or Chile anymore. I'd just go to him. And that's what Jason and I will be working with him. So I'll put a shout in for those guys. So if anybody wants an epic adventure on motorbikes, reach out to him.
That sounds incredible. And I know that it's getting late over there. You're calling from Montana. I know I got to crash here pretty soon. So I'm wondering what you're going to have for dinner tonight. But before I ask you that, I also know that you're a little bit of a foodie and a wild game foodie. And I saw something about grouse tartare. I don't know if it was on your social media or where, but you know, we talked about grouse earlier, the wood chicken, you know, like that animal is one, like we've flushed a few of them last week. And I just like, I got the itchy trigger finger. You know what I mean? Like they're such a fun game to go after. But what is your favorite wild game meal to prepare?
Well, I love the game, but I love grouse. Served raw, it's spectacular. And Kevin, next time you shoot one, trust me on that. Just
try it raw.
Take all that sinew, scrape the meat, mix it with a bit of onion, egg, have it on a bit of fried bread. You will never cook one again.
Really?
I promise you.
Oh, okay.
But
I've done that
with Mark. I've done it with Marco Polo sheep in Tajikistan. I've done it. I mean, you're not going to go and do it with a fox, a walrus or wild boar, because obviously they have trichinosis and such like. But anything that doesn't carry that, I'll always try it raw. And I mean, I was in Africa a few years ago and a raptor caught a guinea fowl under us. And I was with a PH. She's a female, actually, in Botswana. And she said, oh, those things are shy to eat. And I said, no, I took it back. We tartared the guinea fowl and everybody was blown away with it. So I'd encourage people to try. I love all of these things. And plus, it's simplicity, because if you're out in the mountains, you're just saving a bit of gas or fuel as well, mm-hmm. if you can do it. So I'm up for trying anything. As long as you're safe about it, it's super cool.
Yeah, it amazes me how far some of these kind of hybrid chefs that are also hunters are taking the outdoors cuisine. We have a guy in Utah, a good friend of mine, who's helped out on some classes, Mike O'Brien. So shout out to Fly Fish With Me Utah. And Mike was about to go on one of these Hollywood cooking shows, and he made it very far in the process. And then the Hollywood cooking show was like, oh, wait a minute. Wait. You are into shooting things with a rifle and a shotgun? Like, I think they just wanted him to be like a fisherman and a bow hunter, and they didn't like the gun thing. It was one of those politically correct things. And they said, we don't want you. And they let him go. But there are some guys out there that are so talented with wild game. It would rival a fancy restaurant in downtown Vail or Park City, you know?
Well, I will always go for wild game. So this is another thing in the UK we can do. There's a restaurant in London, for example, called Rules. It's the oldest restaurant in London. If anybody's going over there, you should try it. And it's all wild game. So you can have hare, grouse, woodcock, venison, blah, blah, blah. But cooked in this place, it's like stepping back in time. So it's great. I take my kids there every Christmas. We have a real good crack because I do like to live it up when I get a chance and dress up in my little bit. But it doesn't happen very often because I tend to be in the woods a lot on the mountains. But I do like a crack like that. And those kind of wild games just so undervalued, I think. And getting back to like that program and your chef, mate, I think that's kind of that fires me off because we've got nothing to hide. Hunting done properly is something we should be really proud about doing. You know, I harp on about this all the time, but we've got only good stories to tell. If it's done the right way, we just need to educate people. And I spend my time preaching to the converted. That's my problem. I need to start preaching to people that don't understand hunting. And better, and that's why I like taking vegetarians and vegans out. Say, come out, have a go. Right. And that's extremely rewarding for me because it's a good story. We're just not telling it necessarily as well as we should.
And I think that's the message we should leave this on, is that if you guys are listening and if these ideas are clicking with you, if they're resonating with you, don't preach to the choir. I mean, granted, you can talk about, hey, we just heard these guys talking about hunting and fishing and traveling and whatnot to your friends who are into it, but be brave and go out there and talk to the person who you know is going to push back. Because we need those people to eventually.
They're the ones we need to get out, Kevin. Mm-hmm. If you've got somebody living in your street or whatever that's the reluctant one, say, come out, give it a go. We need to get these people on side because guess what? You know, as I talk about the UK, there's so much anti-hunting flavor now, particularly from the dear old BBC, our British Broadcasting Company, which is publicly funded, by the way, which really annoys me because we all pay for them to provide this public, but a lot of the journalists or reporters are so biased and anti-hunting. And it's, you think, God, we need to fix this. And then I'm turning into a whinging old man, so I won't harp on about that too much, Kevin. But I could say a lot. We could do a whole podcast.
Yeah, we could. But before we go, where can people follow you? Where can they keep up with what you're doing, find your products and all that great stuff?
So we've got some great outlets. We're growing, as I say. So the websites, you put Javelin Bipod in or Javelin Bipod, you'll find us, or Spartan Precision Equipment. And there's an Instagram there, Spartan Precision. And I've got my own little, where I share my little political view. I don't take myself too serious, so it's Spartan Mr. G. That's on Instagram. We have Brandy Rock Canyon in the U.S., there's more and more companies taking it on. There's a company called Happy Antelope that sells us on Amazon in the States. They're doing a great job. We do ship direct to the US. We're now looking at fulfillment in the US, and that's going to happen before the year's out. So because then we can get the products to people quicker. It's growing. They've just got to bear with us. We're a little company and we're growing fast, but it's a good story. And we'll just keep on listening to people and trying to do the best we can.
Yeah, please keep doing what you're doing. It's inspirational. It is absolutely necessary. I love the idea that you're combining all of your interests into one, the backpacking, the fishing, the hunting, the shooting, all of it into one. It's such a great message, and it's a great thing that you're doing. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Reach out to me after this and we'll get you some gear set up so you can go and test it and you give me your feedback. But, I don't get many complaints.
Oh, I definitely will. And stay on after we sign off and we'll talk a little bit more. But guys, for now, thank you so much for listening. Go please check out Spartan Precision Equipment and Rob Gehring at Spartan Mr. G. And we'll see you next time on the podcast. Thanks so much.